podcast dedicated to sharing rich content for the purpose of spiritual growth. I'm your host, Shalom Agdarap. The Academy creates transformative space for people to connect with God, self, others, and creation for the sake of the world. To learn more about the Academy, visit academy.upperroom.org. We get to hear from one of our very own Amas in the church today. Elaine Heath's vocational journey includes having served as Dean of the Divinity School at Duke University and the Michaelis Professor of Evangelism at Perkins School of Theology. She is a pioneer in new forms of theological education. And in that capacity, Heath is co-founder and former president of Neighborhood Seminary. The author of 13 books, Heath is an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church and served in pastoral ministry prior to her academic ministry. She lives with her husband at Spring Forest, an intentional Christian community and farm in rural North Carolina, where she serves as abbess. Elaine will speak to us of hopes and expectations, of well-formed theology that becomes undone by lived experience. Knowing about Jesus and experiencing the compassion and presence of Jesus in the neighborhood is nothing short of transformational. Listen on, dear one, and as you listen, breathe deeply and expand gently.
But this is the neighborhood where I lived when I graduated from seminary. This is in East Liverpool, Ohio, and I lived in that house. And it looked about like that when I lived in it. East Liverpool, Ohio was a bustling town that was a good place to raise a family, a working class town for a long time. It's on the Ohio River. And there were potteries, there were steel mills, there was industry. It was a great place to make a living, and you didn't have to have a college degree to make a decent living for your family. And then outsourcing came. And the whole place very quickly fell into poverty. Those jobs were outsourced, the steel mills were closed, the potteries were closed. And then when that happened, as often happens in communities where there's poverty and there's a river, guess what moved in? Chemical plants, a toxic waste incinerator that was across the street and down a little bit from the elementary school that burned suspicious things at night. And I remember when I was talking to an emergency room nurse as part of my being on the chaplain rotation at the local hospital, as the pastors do. She said that they could always tell when that one suspicious whatever it was being burned, because the emergency room would be flooded with people who couldn't breathe. And she said they had people diagnosed with conditions that didn't have names, where their lungs were crystallizing because of the toxins in the air. The place was filled with toxins of all kinds. And this neighborhood, that used to be a very affluent physician's house back long ago when the town was bustling. And now it was a parsonage next to the United Methodist Church. I didn't serve that particular church. I served a three-point charge, which means three little churches that are connected, if you're not a Methodist, about 10 miles out in the country. They were 5 miles apart. They were the three churches from the Book of Revelation. One was hot, one was cold, and one was lukewarm. So the inside of this house was beautiful, but the woodwork was beautiful, hardwood window frames, and it had good bones. But the paint was peeling off because the chemicals in the air made the paint peel off of houses. You couldn't keep it on. And no amount of activism, even by important celebrities and people with power, no amount of activism could get the government to say that, you know what, we've made a mistake here, we need to clean up the air. And it's because the people living in that community were poor. Environmental devastation and poverty of people are always connected. So that's where I lived, brand new, fresh out of seminary. I graduated at the top of my class, summa cum laude. I graduated at the top of my class when I went to college while I was raising teenagers, summa cum laude from a state university. Now think about where I came from, right?
Yeah.
Think about where I came from. Now the reason that I think I graduated summa cum laude from everywhere was I was so full of anxiety. I had to just keep going and doing everything. I just had to. Got to get an A on that paper or the sky will fall. That was my response to all of that stuff. And I also had good mentors. Thanks be to God. Good mentors, good friends, beautiful people. So here I was, and I grew up in poverty, but not that particular type of neighborhood. I had never lived in a neighborhood like that one. And so it was a different context for me. It was a neighborhood right behind, here's the driveway. The church was over here. There's an alley behind here, and then right behind the church across the alley was an active crack house with prostitutes. And the neighborhood was filled with little children who were just wandering around and riding their bicycles and hoping that they could get something to eat, and their parents who were struggling. And there were households there with mom and dad both working several minimum wage jobs and still can't pay all the bills. It was like that, right? Some beautiful people and some devastated people. So there I was. And of course, part of my internal world at that time was wanting to leave behind forever the trauma I experienced growing up. Just not wanting to think about it, not wanting to look at it. I just wanted to leave it behind. I was proud of myself for going to school and raising my children. I felt good about that. I'm still proud of that. I think that was a wonderful thing. It was a blessing. Couldn't have done it without friends, right? But I didn't want to focus on any of that. Didn't talk about it. Didn't tell those stories at all. But I came to a point where I hit a wall. By this time, I was in kind of late 30s, early 40s. And for many of us, especially for women, we start waking up to some things at that age. If we're maturing in a sort of normal way, start waking up to some things. So there I was, and I wanted so much to be the pastor who preaches well, who leads well, who knows how to do spiritual formation well, and all this. I wanted to do everything with excellence, and inside I'm just torn apart. So I was doing some really hard grief work. And I was in the living room of that house. I was by myself. It was like a Tuesday morning or something. There was nobody around other than trucks driving by. You know, I was in that house, and I was crying. I was weeping. I was wailing. I hate crying in front of people because my face swells up. Every opening, you know, exudes mucus. I'm just a big mess. And then I can't breathe, and I hiccup a lot. It's just awful. So I'm in this room wailing. I'm keening, at times shrieking, because I needed to get that out. And I was remembering these things and doing this, and all of a sudden on the front door, pound, 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 pound. There's somebody pounding on the front door. Won't stop pounding, won't stop pounding, won't stop pounding. I'm in there. I'd been feeling utterly God-forsaken all morning. Where was God when these things happened? Why isn't God there when these things happen to people? Pound, 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 and I just froze. I froze. Stopped crying. I was like a statue. Who's at the door? I am not opening that door. And they were not going to stop pounding. So finally, I just kind of took a towel and wiped my face off. I go to the door, I open it just a crack, and it's the woman from the crack house. The woman from the crack house, this little, scrawny, raggedy-looking woman with bad teeth and just emaciated-looking, and she pushes the door open. She says, honey, and she's looking past me. She says, honey, I heard you crying. Are you all right? And she's looking for who's hurting me, because she's going to take them on. It just changed everything for me. Jesus came to me in that woman who sold her body so she could have the crack. Jesus came to me. Is Jesus allowed to do such things? It ruined my theology. How does this happen? Jesus was already in that neighborhood. There was something in this woman that was fiercely protective. She knew what it was like to cry like that because she knew what kind of pain causes that kind of crying. And by God, she was going to come to my aid. Jesus and a crack woman. I told her with hiccups and snot, I'll be okay. I'm crying about some things that happened a long time ago. She said, all right. Then, you know, one last look around. And I thanked her for coming. This was a pivot point in my theology. It was a pivot point in my personal growth to realize that Jesus was in the neighborhood already, in the strengths of the people, in the capacity of the people to be with others. That woman was an empathetic witness to me as I relived trauma. The Apostles' Creed, one of the earliest creeds of the church, which is a distillation of what Christians believed, and this was used to prepare people for baptism and to have some sort of guidance as new faith communities were formed. These are the things that are important to us to hold on to. And what does it mean to love and trust God the Father? Or in our language today, God who's father and mother, God who's parent, God who's creator. To love and trust Jesus the Son, Jesus the Redeemer. What does it mean to love and trust that? To love and trust the Spirit? Loving and trusting are hard when you have trauma from childhood. You've learned not to love and trust. Not really. There's a place deep inside that you keep locked up so that you can cope, you can survive, you can make it. To love and trust, to lean into God, what does it mean? So I remember the first time I saw this icon of the resurrection. This is from the Orthodox tradition. Of course, you know probably from your studies in this academy that you don't pray to icons. It's not an act of idolatry or something like that. Icons are theological texts that are visual instead of words. And in the icon, in the tradition of iconography, they are written as theological texts. And the way people pray with icons is to sit with them and have a heart that's open to God, for God to give us insight and wisdom, direction, as we are in the presence of the icon, just like we would reading a sacred book or something like that. So one of the beautiful friends that God gave me in seminary was a Greek Orthodox monk, Father Michael. And he gave this icon to me and explained to me, this is back when I was just learning about icons, right? He explained to me that this is Christ, the risen Christ, and he's pulling Adam and Eve, corporate humanity, Adam, remember from yesterday and the day before, pulling them up out of hell. Just broke their caskets open, pulling them right out of hell. Here's death. Death has been taken captive. Look at death's all like, oh, leave me alone. He said, that's the risen Christ. That's what Christ does. Christ pulls us out of hell. So this became an icon that I prayed with because Christ had pulled me out of hell. I can love and trust the Christ who comes into hell where I'm stuck and pulls me out of hell. And isn't this what our neighbors need from us? For us to be glad to go into the hell, wherever the hell is, wherever the people are stuck, wherever oppression is happening, wherever people are in bondage, wherever people are in a casket, wherever death is having its way with them. We looked at what die means yesterday. But for us to go there gladly with Jesus, we never go there without Jesus. Jesus is always going to hell and pulling people up out of hell. This is what Jesus does. And what would it look like for us as faith communities to gladly go there with Jesus? Isn't that the job of the church? Jesus said to Peter, your name is Peter. Do you remember this scripture? Your name is Peter, which means rock, right? And on this rock, a little wordplay going on this rock, I will build my church. And what comes next in that scripture? Gates of hell will not prevail. So Jesus is describing hell as a gated community. And when the church shows up in this way with Jesus, the gate, that guy that stands in that little booth thing, he runs off and forgets to block the way, and they go into the hell and take up residence with people. And liberty happens. Healing happens. Shalom starts happening, and the process of uncursing starts to happen. This wonderful, complex, richly nuanced process of uncursing happens. And the gates of hell will not prevail, Jesus said. This is the work of the church. This is our vocation. Evelyn Underhill, who wrote the classic text, Mysticism, which is about mysticism. Evelyn Underhill, who was an agnostic, I believe this was after World War I, right around World War I, an agnostic because of all the devastation. So many people lost their faith, struggled with faith because of the devastation and the cruelty and the weapons of mass destruction in the trenches and so on. And she went to Friedrich von Hugel, who was a Catholic scholar who did spiritual direction with people. So she went to him for spiritual direction. And she says that he was so kind to her, and he suffered from horrible migraines all the time too, but somehow he kept doing this beautiful work despite the migraines. So she goes to him, and after a period of time, she would go, and she was an intellectual, so she'd have all these objections to things. You know, she just want to fight with ideas of things. And he was there, and he would talk with her and listen. And then at the end of their time together, he would pray. And she said, finally, at the end, it was being with him when he prayed that won her heart. Because he was so translucent with the Spirit of God when he prayed. So she became a Christian, a kind of reluctant Christian. Studied mysticism, wrote this classic text, and then wrote a number. As she got older, she started doing retreats every year. And she would prepare a set of retreat talks once a year, and everywhere she'd go, she'd give the same talks. She was economical that way. And she wrote a number of little books. Practical Mysticism is my favorite one. And The House of the Soul and Concerning the Inner Life. I recommend those two to you. Practical Mysticism and The House of the Soul / Concerning the Inner Life. Evelyn Underhill. So in Practical Mysticism, she says this. Your average terrier, there's Bonnie, the average terrier. Your average terrier is a better Christian than your average Christian. Your average terrier is a better mystic than your average Christian, because a terrier is present to what is there. It sees and smells and is completely alert to what is there and doesn't worry about notions and facts and names of things and systems of thought and creating a religious museum and, you know. So she says, you can learn much from the average terrier about what it means to practice contemplation and being present in love to the God who is love. So this is what she said. So this is really what we have to do. This is what's being called for now by the Spirit, regardless of our denomination or whether we're liberals or conservatives or whether we're Republicans or Democrats or whatever it is, right? Angry people, kind of confused people. This is what the Spirit's calling for right now is discernment. Discernment that leads to loving action. Not just discernment that we write it in our journal and then go about our business, but discernment that leads to loving action, that leads us to gladly go to hell with Jesus. And I mean that, gladly. Gladly. So this is the way I experience living in that space. I'm not always good at it. Sometimes I'm really bad at it. Sometimes I get tired. Sometimes I'm impatient. Sometimes I just want to take a break. It's a good thing Jesus is patient. But this is the four parts, and they're not even like steps. They're sort of simultaneous processes that go on all the time. This showing up. So we show up to ourselves, to our neighbors. We show up to God. We show up to our neighborhood. I started showing up to that neighborhood in a different way after that woman came to help me. We pay attention. What is going on here? Why does my stomach hurt today? That's a familiar feeling. It's anxiety. Why am I anxious today? Oh, it's that meeting we had last night. And the thing that person said that's unresolved. And now I've got to figure out whether to call her, go see her, ignore it. I shouldn't send an email. You see what I'm saying? And how can we show up and pay attention if we don't have open space and silence in our lives where we can be present to ourselves in a compassionate and honest way? And then as we're showing up and we're paying attention, and I so appreciated what Bishop Hisu talked about yesterday with these different practices that can help us and what happens when we practice silence and solitude. Then we can gain clarity. Oh, this is the thing I need to do today. This is where I need to aim my life over the next few years. I need to go this way and not these other ways that are interesting. Oh, this is how I need to spend my money and not that way. So we cooperate with God. We cooperate. And I deliberately use that collaborative language because I do not experience God ever being coercive. I just don't. I don't see God being coercive in Jesus. Jesus doesn't force anyone to follow him. When the sons of thunder, James and John, remember them? They want Jesus to smite. They want Jesus to call down fire from heaven. They want to call down fire from heaven. They want to be the executioners. Call down fire from heaven on a group of hapless Samaritans that are just not interested in what they have to say. And they want to just burn him up, incinerate him. This is the one time where this topic comes up in Scripture where somebody directly asks Jesus if they can burn people who won't accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior. And Jesus, one of the translations uses poor grammar. He says, you don't know the spirit that you're of or something like that, but it ends with a preposition. Okay. No, you can't. You can't burn them up. You can't do that. What is wrong with you people? This is how Jesus responds, which tells us what God is like, right? So we cooperate with the God who's like Jesus. Jesus shows us what God is like. We cooperate with that God, and we must do so with enormous courage, with love and trust, because we do not know what the outcome will be when we cooperate with God. We don't know. There's no guarantee of a particular outcome. 5,000 might be fed. The storm might be stilled. The pigs might go off the cliff and the people might run us out of town. We don't know what's going to happen. People might raise from the dead. People might turn around and go in the right direction. Wondrous things can happen, and we might be taken to the city dump and nailed to a cross. We don't know what's going to happen. What we know is Jesus will go with us because we're going with Jesus. In our congregations that are terribly stuck and there's so much systems anxiety and people jockeying for preserving something and having power and fighting over who gets to do what, you can pray for openings. Even the tiniest opening is enough where God can go and dwell there and influence change. So this is what we do. We show up, we pay attention, we cooperate with God, and we really do need to release the outcome because we don't know what the outcome will be of a particular act. We don't know. We can't control it.
Elaine. Jane says this is what we do. We show up, we pay attention, we cooperate with God. And we really do need to release the outcome because we don't know what the outcome will be of a particular act. I must share, I had all kinds of deja vu listening to her presentation once again, because I was part of the leadership team of the two-year academy where Elaine presented this very talk. I was in the room where it happened. And just 2 weeks later, in March 2020, that retreat center would be shut down. Flights would be canceled. We would be sheltering in place, and we were very much scared for our lives. Churches and schools closed down soon after, and direct services grinded to a halt. Elaine could not have known that her way of teaching incarnational spirituality, of showing up, paying attention, and cooperating with God, and releasing the outcome, would be a footpath for many to tread in the years of unknowing that have followed since. But she reminds us that discernment that leads us to loving action with Jesus is what we must focus on now, versus a narrow and frankly tired conversation on how to grow the church in terms of worship attendance and financial giving. Her talk begs these questions of who are you in discernment with about where Jesus is showing up in your neighborhood? How are you cultivating God's shalom among the most impacted without care of a ROI, return on investment, for your particular faith community? In light of mass killings and forced starvation in the world, surely we are being called into loving action with Jesus. So what does that look like for you and your neighbors today? Blessings as you move throughout your neighborhood and figure out what your discernment and what your response might be. To hear more from faculty and wisdom guides like Elaine, join us at the next online or in-person Academy retreat. For more information, visit academy.upperroom.org.